You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning. My name is Suzanne Maloney, and I'm the Vice President and Director of Foreign Policy at the Brookings Institution. It's my great pleasure to welcome all of you here today for an online conversation on China's approach to the world, especially around global governance and norms. This morning's webinar helped launch a grouping of papers that examine China's efforts to expand its influence in international institutions and shape global norms. This research forms a key part of the Brookings Project on Global China, assessing China's role in the world. Global China is a two-year Brookings Foreign Policy Initiative that seeks to provide an empirical baseline for understanding China's global role across wide-ranging geographic and functional areas. This project involves scholars from across the Brookings Institution, as well as outside experts with deep insight on China. The project uses a cross-disciplinary approach, drawing not just from Brookings' deep bench of China and East Asia experts, but also from the institution's security, strategy, regional studies, technology, and economic scholars. This approach has generated an eclectic set of perspectives on China's behavior and its impacts. The papers released this month are the penultimate in the series. As the United Nations celebrates its 75th year, the papers launched as part of this project examine China's interactions with UN agencies and provide a glimpse into China's ambitions for setting rules on the international stage. The papers examine how China deploys a diversity of methods and tools in advancement of its ambitions. The findings also raise critical questions about how China's growing activism will impact the rules, norms, and institutions at the heart of the modern international system. To help advance our thinking on these questions, we're delighted to welcome a panel of authors to this Brookings webinar. We will have Jeff Feltman to discuss China's expanding reach at the United Nations and how the United States should react. Sophie Richardson of the Human Rights Watch to examine China's greater engagement with the global human rights system. Lindsay Ford on China's efforts to reshape Asia's regional security architecture. And David Shulman of the International Republican Institute on the competition of political systems. All moderated by Patrick Quirk, a non-resident fellow here at Brookings Foreign Policy, who co-authored a piece with David for this series as well. Now, before we move on to the formal session, I need to note that outside of their work for Brookings, our scholars occasionally advise political candidates on the issues in accordance with the institution's policy on nonpartisanship. That policy can be found on the Brookings website, and all affiliations are disclosed on individual expert pages on the website. A final reminder that we are on the record and streaming live, so please send your questions to us on Twitter using the hashtag GlobalChina. Before I hand over the mic, I would like to thank the Ford Foundation for their generous support of this initiative. And with that, I'll pass it over to Patrick Quirk to guide the panel discussion. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Suzanne, and welcome again to everyone logged in and joining us today for this important conversation about China's approach to global governance and norms. A few words about the run of show before we proceed. I will ask each presenter a few questions, starting with Lindsay. After each panelist responds, I'll invite the other experts to weigh in. We'll do this for each of the four panelists, and then take questions from all of you in the audience. With that, let's begin. Central to any discussion of China's engagement with global governance and norms is security. For insights on this, we'll look to Lindsay Ford, who is David M. Rubenstein Fellow in Foreign Policy with Brookings. So Lindsay, to what extent, in your opinion, are traditional US security partners in Asia, such as South Korea, Thailand, and Japan, aligned or engaged with China's regional security architecture? And if they are, how might that reflect on America's influence and relations in the region? Over to you.
Thanks, Patrick. So first, I think it's important for those who may not live in the wonky world of Asian security relationships to at least say what exactly is a regional security architecture. So we're really talking about things ranging from bilateral alliance and partnership relationships up to multilateral institutions. You know, the most formal of those would be things like we have in Europe, like NATO. When it comes to building regional security networks, I think the Chinese are deploying an approach that works on multiple levels. the real opportunities are actually in places like, say, Central Asia, the Mekong region, where the U.S. has traditionally had much of a less noticeable security role. And that's where you've seen the Chinese in Asia build much deeper activities and exercises, border patrols, cyber terrorism exercises, even overseas facilities in some places. So that's where the opportunities for significant inroads are. But when it comes to allies, it's a different approach. I don't think any of the allies you named would call themselves, quote, aligned with China. But what the Chinese have done in some ways is try to neutralize the significance of those alliances. We've seen this with South Korea, where the decision to deploy a U.S. missile system back in 2016, 2017 really resulted in a lot of economic coercion, boycotts that helped shape the decisions that the South Koreans are willing to take, in particular on things like regional missile defenses or trilateral cooperation with the U.S. and the Japanese. I highlighted Thailand in my paper in particular as well, because I think it's an important example of how the Chinese build relationships. A lot of times it's opportunistic. What we've seen in some cases is with Thailand, multiple coups really diminished the ability of the U.S. and Thailand to have a strong security relationship. China stepped into the gap in a lot of ways. It's now a significant arms sale partner with the Thais. And the result of that is potentially long lasting, because they use those relationships to facilitate training, exercises, the kinds of things that the U.S. has done over the last 40 years to create a much broader and more far-reaching security relationship.
Great. Thanks, Lindsay. So picking up on that, does China's rising participation in security networks play a role perhaps in ensuring stability across the region? And if so, to what degree is that stability perhaps being offset by recent tensions that China has with regional actors like India and other South China Sea claimants across Southeast Asia?
That's a great question. I think offset is exactly the right word to be using, because I think the theory of the case for many years, certainly following the Cold War, for both the U.S. and a lot of China's neighbors, was that if China was participating more actively in regional security institutions, that would be a good thing overall for regional security. So you saw the U.S. encourage the Chinese to participate in things like anti-piracy cooperation together. As recently as 2014, the U.S. was inviting China to participate in RIMPAC, which is the largest naval exercise that we do in the region. And there's any number of regional threats, proliferation, disaster relief, where ultimately regional responses would be stronger and more effective if the Chinese were there playing a positive cooperative role. The problem is that what we've seen in a lot of cases is these interactions, more routine interactions that may occur multilaterally, aren't necessarily offsetting a lot of the other things that China's doing in the region. So in Myanmar, for example, there have been a lot of mass atrocities against the Rohingya people. There's active violence going on in the region. China's selling arms both to the government, and in some cases, we've seen arms flowing to rebel groups as well. It doesn't contribute to stability. Participating in disaster relief exercises doesn't actually matter if in cases like the 2013 typhoon that hit the Philippines, the Chinese offer up disaster relief right afterwards. It's less than what IKEA was offering. And, you know, part of the problem here is that China's talking about cooperative security mechanisms, but it's unwilling to take more meaningful steps, things like being transparent about its military investments, resolving territorial disputes that would actually contribute to stability in a much more substantial way in the region. And you've seen this over the past several months, like you said, encroaching on the exclusive economic zones of its neighbors just this past week, crossing the midpoint of the Taiwan Strait, the China-India border crisis. The facts on the ground just don't suggest that what China is doing is actually making the region more stable rather than less stable.
Great. Thanks, Lindsay. All really excellent points. Given that the security piece cuts across most everything else, I'd like to open it up to our other panelists, David, Jeffrey, Sophie. Any thoughts on these two questions or reactions to Lindsay's points? Other remarks you'd like to make?
Well, I can jump in. I think all the points that Lindsay made were excellent. I would say one thing that struck me, and this was in her paper as well, was identifying how the role that China is playing economically in the region, specifically through the Belt and Road Initiative, but also through just other economic leverage that China has developed, as I did to the fact that it's a $14 trillion economy and it's so central to Asia's economy in particular, is really driving a lot of these relationships and creating certain amounts of leverage for sure and incentives for actors in these countries to side more with China, even in the security domain. It's typically been thought of, you know, we have the China rising and China's going to be central economically and building those bonds in the region. But that the security piece would always be, you know, that these countries were more aligned with the United States because of the mounting China threat and China being in the neighborhood. But, you know, I think looking at the role that those economic incentives play, looking at the role that China as more of a provider of digital technology and other sorts of things, these elements are going to be really critical as we think through what does the security architecture look like in Asia and further afield. And then just the other thought that I had, and this is more in the diplomatic domain, not purely in the security, but just, you know, the comparison that you can make in terms of what China's been trying to do in terms of the security architecture in Asia with ASEAN plus one and plus three and the KIKA conference and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. And then in other regions, such as Africa with the Forum on China-Africa Cooperation or the 17 plus one arrangement in Europe, or to some degree China CELAC in Latin America, these all kind of look fairly similar to what China's trying to do in Asia, where it's kind of eliminating or at least diminishing the role of the U.S. in these regional engagements and setting up these situations where it's China and the region having these more closed engagements where China can be more dominant and have more leverage. So just a few thoughts there.
Thanks, Dave. Sophie, Jeffrey, anything to add? The security piece certainly reflects on the UN system. So for that, let's shift the discussion to China's role in the United Nations and move to Jeffrey Feltman, who is John C. Whitehead Visiting Fellow in International Diplomacy with Brookings. So Jeffrey, really liked your paper, as I did Lindsay's. To start, has China's recent increased participation in the UN notably improved its international standing? And if so, could you remark on which nations in particular? And linked to this, to what extent has China's growing presence in the UN been cause for trepidation and animosity in other UN participants, particularly in industrialized or Western countries? So looking forward to your thoughts.
Patrick, thank you. It's an honor to be part of this panel today. I mean, the reality is China is now the second largest contributor in assessed contributions, that is the mandatory dues to the UN at 12% compared to 22% for the US, the number one donor. And on peacekeeping, it's also the second with 15% of the assessed contributions versus about 28% for the US. And given China's weight in the world, I think it's natural that China wants to have a louder voice at the UN. I think most people understand that China wants to have a louder voice at the UN, wants to have more influence inside the institution that has traditionally played, given its size. That's the reality. Whether it's welcomed by some or it's seen, to use your words, with trepidation by some is the question worth exploring. And going back in time to sort of almost a golden age of multilateralism from an American perspective would be the immediate post-Cold War period, you know, the period after 1989 when it was a unipolar world. And during that time, the sort of liberal world order that animates the sort of operating system of the UN was greatly expanded. You know, you had concepts like responsibility to protect, meaning that countries could almost had a responsibility to go in and intervene in places where there were massacres, where local governments were not protecting their people. You had a great expansion of the normative agenda on human rights. This made a lot of global South countries uncomfortable. They saw all these new concepts coming out of the UN as being a invitation for the global North to interfere in the internal affairs of the global South. So these countries that fall into that category, and I think they tend to be autocratic. They don't have much respect for human rights of their population. These countries welcome the fact that China is having greater influence inside the United Nations because they were uncomfortable with where the United States, Europe, were pushing the global agenda inside the United Nations. So they very much welcome China's greater voice because China for example, we'll talk about the rule of law in international relations. They changed the debate from the rule of law being about people, to rule of law being about relations between states. And autocratic leaders in the global south or elsewhere tend to like that. Those that view China's rights with trepidations are our traditional allies, are those that care about the normative agenda of the United Nations, those that care about maintaining the sort of liberal operating system that animates the multilateral system. But the problem is right now that there's rather a vacuum where the U.S. leadership used to be. That the United States would like to deny China having a leadership role in the multilateral system while not exercising itself, while creating vacuums that China can easily fill. So the concern of those who are worried about China's rise are related not only to China's rise, but by the lack of sustained pushback by the United States, by the traditional leader in the system. I think about a European diplomat from a small European country told me in a meeting just before the pandemic shut down personal meetings. He said, "Look, Jeff, you need to know China approaches us on everything on the UN agenda. China lobbies us on everything. And if the US is absent, and this is an issue that doesn't matter that much to us, why wouldn't we just accede to what China's asking?" So the lack of US leadership combined with China's rise is what's leading to that trepidation.
Great. Thanks for that, Jeffrey. Picking up on that point with regard to China leaning in your paper in discussing China's attempts to expand influence in the UN system, you write that, quote, "China has deployed its Security Council veto only 16 times, less than any of the other permanent members. That it's at its current rate, China will surely soon outstrip France in using its veto privilege." So if this occurs, can you speak to how, if at all, gridlocked this will make the UN system going forward?
Well, I mean, the reality is, of course, that the Security Council hardly reflects the world's demographic or economic or political powers of today. But it's very hard to imagine reinventing the Security Council right now in this polarized world. So we have to deal with what we have rather than what we should have. And I don't know that the Security Council becomes more polarized because of China's increasing use of the veto. China vetoed two resolutions along with Russia in as recently as July. What concerns me more is that China could very well gain the power to deny the passage of Security Council resolutions without using the veto. And while in the end it doesn't make any difference, if the Security Council resolution doesn't pass, there's sort of a more of a humiliation factor. If China can deny a resolution from passing that say the U.S., the U.K. and France were supporting without using the veto, that's sending a very strong message about the influence it has. Now, how could they do that? You need 9 votes in the Security Council, 9 affirmative votes to pass a resolution. And no vetoes, obviously, from one of the 5 permanent members of the Security Council. China has done a very good job of cultivating its ties with the G77 and cultivating its ties with the non-aligned movement. You know, over the years, as well as, of course, using cash with some of its infrastructure projects in London. So the African states always have 3 members in the Security Council. They're called the A3. China aligns its policies with the A3 on Africa-related issues. That means that China can probably call in its chits if there's something important before the Security Council with the A3. China also has strong ties with non-aligned movement elsewhere. And China and Russia, despite whatever tensions there may be in their bilateral relationship from time to time, inside the Security Council today are aligned. So you could sort of see how China could assemble the votes to deny a US, UK, French draft from passing without having to use the visa, without having to use its veto, meaning that it's a stronger message to be able to deny the votes than to have to use a veto. They will use the veto if it's a national interest, and they see it as necessary. But I'm more worried about how they've cultivated other allies on the council. And for the United States, we're going to just have to accept the fact that we need to be pursuing rivalry with China and cooperation with China when we can simultaneously. The way this worked in the Cold War when it was a Washington-Moscow rivalry was a lot of times there were negotiations offline to work on ceasefires or to reduce tensions that were then brought to the Security Council for endorsement. And I think that's the model that we need to be seeing in looking at how to work with the Security Council going forward, is have some of the middle powers work with Washington and Beijing to de-escalate problems and then bring it to the Security Council, but do not expect the Security Council itself to solve the issues, merely to endorse something that's been decided offline.
Great. Thanks so much, Jeffrey. With that, I'd like to open up to the other panelists. We'd very much welcome your thoughts on Jeffrey's paper, the two questions we've talked about here, in particular, implications of China's increased engagement in the U.S. system, and perhaps any thoughts as to how the United States should approach this.
Yeah, Patrick, can I jump in and put a question to Jeff?
Absolutely.
Yeah, Jeff, it's hard to disagree with anything that you've just sketched out. I guess I'd be curious for your thoughts about whether you see Chinese diplomats or the Chinese foreign ministry in some occasions or in some ways overstepping and creating a little bit of pushback. In the last year or so, we've seen, for example, a couple of states quietly dissociate themselves after the fact from Chinese government statements. Occasions when some governments have found out that Chinese diplomats signed the other government up to their statements without asking them, leaving them in the position of having to ask to be removed from them. And I just wonder if, or even look at, for example, the vote on the most recent version of the mutually beneficial cooperation resolution at the Human Rights Council, which was a very different response this year than from a couple of years ago. And some of the governments that voted against it this time, you know, really do fall into that category of G77 or Global South governments. And so I'd just be interested in your views about whether overly aggressive maneuvers like this might not be producing an outcome that Beijing doesn't want.
Sophie, I think you're absolutely right. And I think that there's an opportunity for, you know, like-minded states to come together and push back now, because I think there is rising concern among some states about the aggressiveness, about the wolf diplomacy, et cetera. And in fact, it was what the conversation I had that I described earlier was look, we're frustrated. We want to be able to push back against this, but we here at the mission to the United Nations are seeing what's happening, are seeing the increasing aggressiveness of China trying to, they can't really change the rules so much because the charter is so hard to amend, but to change the sort of norms, to roll back that post-Cold War expansion of the normative agenda of the UN. But our capital is concerned about relations with Beijing. And so we need to have the US leading an effort to push back against this so that we can tell our capital, this is why we're not going to vote with China on this particular issue. But I think that you're absolutely right. I just don't think that we're exploiting that rising concern effectively.
Great. Thanks for that, Jeffrey. Dave, Lindsay, anything to add here? Implications of China's increased participation in the UN system for the two issues that you were writing on?
Well, I know that Jeffrey's paper was focused primarily on the political and the security aspects at the UN. And I know that Sophie may get into this a little bit in her remarks. But I mean, obviously, what we've seen in terms of China's effect on the liberal order and on democracy generally, kind of from the, I've been looking at it a lot from the bottom up in individual countries, but from the so-called top down or from the international institution level, clearly what's happening in terms of China's attempt to shape the narrative in the UN and other multilateral institutions about issues such as human rights, about democracy, about the norms that have underpinned the order since its founding, I think are really problematic and something that need to be paid closer attention to. I think it certainly has begun, and specifically in the development space and the way that China's trying to insert language about the Belt and Road Initiative and about its vision of of authoritarian capitalism and the lack of a focus on you know civil and political rights. These sorts of things are critical in what's happening at the United Nations. And so to the extent that there's a growing awareness of that, and perhaps you know in the vein of what Jeffrey was discussing, perhaps on that side, if there's a growing momentum between democratic countries to pay more attention to that and to push back on it, I think that that's a good thing.
The only thing I'd add here, Patrick, that I think is quite interesting is, you know, there's a connection between what Jeff's talking about and what I was talking about at the regional level. And, you know, one thing we've seen is that China is actually trying to build greater connectivity between some of the regional institutions that it really invests in and the UN system, because Chinese diplomats really contrast between what they call as like the quote world order that would be US led and based on US relationships and the UN system, which China tries to hold up as sort of the more legitimate, you know, ordering institution within on the global stage. And so what China likes to do here is take some of the institutions that it's particularly invested in. Let's say, for example, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, where a lot of the norms that China may have a very difficult time actually getting support for on the global level, it can do more successfully in institutions like the SCO. So, for example, anti-terrorism, where the SCO has really sort of embraced China's version of how it talks about terrorists and extremists. It's quite different from the way that the United States would talk about it. It uses the SCO to build ties between the SCO and the UN system to then have the SCO also advocate at the global level for these kinds of norms as well. So that connectivity, I think, is an important part of sort of the overall Chinese approach.
Yeah, excellent point, Lindsay. Thanks so much. So to Dave's earlier point, shifting the conversation from top-down international regional to bottom-up, a key part of any discussion of China's engagement with norms is its relationship with democracy, in particular how its trade practices and sharp power efforts might undermine democratic practices in target countries. For that, we're going to move to David Shulman, who is senior advisor with the International Republican Institute and adjunct senior fellow with the Center for New American Security. So Dave, starting off, to what degree do you see the stresses facing democratic institutions in other countries as new and evolving, or perhaps as a reflection of longstanding weaknesses that have not been addressed? And then assessing that question, how do you view the relative balance in causes between external factors such as China's influence and internal pressures that those governments and regimes are facing? Look forward to your thoughts.
Great. Thanks, Patrick. I think that's the exact right question. You know, a lot of times when I and others are working on the question of to what extent is China having some sort of a negative influence or impact on democracy in individual countries, the pushback is, well, there's problems in these countries that are longstanding. And you know, it's more a kind of question of how are they going to handle this? And is China just walking into a situation where democracy is already corroded? And the answer is absolutely. You know, in so many of these countries, you have longstanding problems around corruption, certainly around a lack of transparency, a lack of a healthy media sector, no tradition really of investigative journalism, weak judiciary sectors, and so weak rule of law, and an inability to translate, you know, electoral victories by democratic actors into actual effective legislating and governing. So, you know, there's a lot of kind of a lot of weakness there that China is able to exacerbate and to take advantage of, in addition to some of those newer problems that these democracies are facing in terms of, you know, what's happening with digital technology and how that's amplifying what's happening in the misinformation space in a lot of these countries. And so China comes in and, you know, perhaps is China, or I should say Chinese government linked entities in a lot of, you know, cases, state-owned enterprises and policy banks are coming in, and what they're doing is they're engaging with these corrupt officials. They're doing it in an environment where there's little transparency, there's little exposure of what China's doing. And then signing up to, you know, having these countries sign up to deals that not only do create levels of debt and dependence in a lot of these countries that are bad for these democracies' long-term financial solvency, but it also creates a situation where, number one, you know, these are investment deals that are not conditioned on good governance, they're not conditioned on human rights. So that increases the ability of illiberal leaders in these countries to ignore or even pay lip service rhetorically to some of the conditions that Western governments and Western development agencies and multilateral banks have traditionally attached to some of these things. And then these deals and these investment projects are actually bolstering the short-term political fortunes of a lot of these illiberal actors, in the sense that they can point to, well, look at these buildings, look at these bridges that we're building, leaving aside, you know, what is the long-term impact for these countries financially. And that also helps bolster these officials. And then, you know, when democratic processes do actually get in the way of what China is trying to achieve in a country, and it is usually, you know, for China, it's about its strategic interests. It's not that they're targeting individual countries to undermine their democracies. It's usually a effective byproduct of what China's doing. But when you do have elections, when you do have, you know, exposure of what China's doing in the media or in the civil society sector, you do see China actually digging in to try to use what we're calling sharp power tools to try to manipulate the political and the information environment to protect China's interests in these countries. So it's taking advantage of the democracy gaps, the government gaps in these countries, and using them to China's advantage. And then the last thing I'll say on this is, you know, what China's also doing is helping to ensure that allies, liberal allies in countries who have reached a certain level of power and are serving China's interests, China is helping to ensure that those leaders stay in power, right? By sharing the training and the technology to better surveil and monitor their own population, to better control the internet, and to effectively override the types of democratic checks that might otherwise be functioning in a system where you had a healthy civil society and a healthy media sector. So, you know, I think just to, you know, to come back to where I started, the balance here is really unique in each country, but it's always going to be the case that I think what's happening at the domestic level in terms of democratic vulnerabilities is critical. And then the extent to which China can take advantage of that is dependent on whatever is the context in which China's operating, and to some extent as well, the level of strategic interest that China has in that country, both economically or potentially for military or other geostrategic purposes.
Did we, it looks like we may have lost Patrick. Oh, he's back.
Sorry about that, everyone. We had a power outage in our neighborhood. I think everyone is trying to log in and live stream this event. So, Lindsay, where were you? And I'll jump back in.
Jump right back in. We hadn't gone on to the next question yet.
All right, excellent. So moving from David's and all of your prescient assessment of that particular threat to democracy, let's shift to solutions, Dave. How should policymakers grapple with this issue? You know, what, if anything, can the United States, as well as its allies in cooperation with those allies, do to shore up countries perhaps vulnerable to Chinese malign influence? And as the United States navigates this really thorny question, what new developments or challenges may arise from the ongoing COVID crisis? Looking forward to your thoughts.
Yeah. You know, there is a lot that the United States and in conjunction, especially with its allies and partners, can do. But the key is that we're going to have to go beyond rhetoric. We're going to have to go beyond strident rhetoric about the China problem for these countries to actually helping them build their resilience and provide solutions that shore up their democracies, right? So, you know, you can think of this in kind of two main buckets. One is, you know, the sorts of democracy and governance assistance that the United States and organizations like mine, like the International Republican Institute, has engaged in for a long time, in terms of just bolstering the foundation of democracy in these countries, making sure there's a healthy civil society sector, making sure there's a healthy independent journalism and media base, making sure that there's a healthy regulatory environment. These sorts of things are really critical so that when China, when countries engage with China, as they will, as we should expect that they will, and when they accept investment for infrastructure, which they desperately need across the developing world, they can do so in a way that actually protects their democratic institutions. So I think that is one key point of part of this. And it's something that I think that lip service has been paid to, but I think, you know, actual resources need to be put behind this and really working with democratic actors and partners in these countries. And then, you know, to some degree also, we really need to be focusing on making sure that there's an understanding in these countries of how China and the Chinese Communist Party operates in particular. it's not just the this kind of, you know, level of resilience and democratic foundation. It's how can you expect that entities tied to the Chinese government are going to come in and are going to come at some of these financing deals? How are they going to come in and try to shape the information space and potentially the political process in order to benefit China's interests, so that these actors are ready to effectively, you know, protect their own house and make sure that their democracies are protected? The other aspect I would say is also just U.S. diplomatic engagement should be championing democratic actors on the ground in these countries, and also, you know, holding illiberal actors to account. I think that that's really important. I think we should be doing that in conjunction with our allies and partners as much as possible. So it's not just, again, the United States versus China in some great power competition, but that it's actually bolstering actors on the ground and that it's a broad-based coalition of democratic countries supporting these types of actors. You know, in terms of the impact of COVID, it's a really important question. I think, you know, we've, as everyone I'm sure knows, we've already seen authoritarian actors in many of these countries around the world using COVID as an excuse for authoritarian power grabs, using it as an excuse to crack down on the media, on healthcare workers, on anyone who doesn't approve of how they're handling these problems. I think, you know, as, you know, the pandemic continues to affect these countries, it's only going to get worse in the sense that, you know, these leaders are facing massive economic societal challenges, and there's going to be the temptation to take the easy way out in terms of taking more of an authoritarian approach to some of these issues, in terms of, you know, if they're feeling like they're getting demands from the populace that they cannot meet, it's going to be increasingly enticing to better monitor and surveil the population, better control messaging that's out there, to ensure that they can stay in power. And I think they're going to be taking lessons from China on how to do that. And I think they'll also be more incentivized to take investment, again, more of these kind of opaque deals from China, again, for short-term political gain, to say, well, we're having economic problems, but look, we've got this investment here and this investment there, leaving aside what the actual terms of those deals are. So I think that's very problematic. And then lastly, I'll say, you know, China has been pushing this narrative throughout the pandemic about its supposedly very effective managing of it at home, leaving aside the origins of the virus, leaving aside the fact that China has used drastic human rights abuses to achieve what it has at home, but kind of trying to contrast that with the failings of democracies such as the United States and some in Europe. And that messaging, I think, is effective in some countries, but it's something that the United States and our allies and partners need to push back on. And we need to be providing democratic solutions to these countries so that they can, you know, use citizen-centered governance responses to COVID, as opposed to grabbing on to the low-hanging fruit that trends in a more liberal direction.
Thanks for that, David. Recognizing that we're going to hear from Sophie soon on the human rights dimension of this conversation, we'd love to open it up to the rest of the panelists to speak to potential impact of China's actions on democratic practices and institutions, competition between political systems, the variant that China has been pushing, as well as what's on offer from the West. I'll pause there. Love to hear from Lindsay, Jeffrey, or Sophie on this.
Thanks, Patrick. So just to jump in, you know, I really agree with a lot of what Dave was saying. You know, I would, I guess, point again that I think there's a relationship between what Dave is talking about and some of what I was saying earlier in terms of the security partnerships and institutions that we care about. In particular, the U.S. for a long time, I think the presumption was the United States and our allies, our alliance network is powerful because it has been grounded for some time in similar values and norms. That is not always the case right now. And China has really taken advantage of the fact that in some places with countries like Turkey, like the Philippines, I mentioned before the coup in Thailand, that some of the erosion of domestic good governance at home and erosion of democracy has actually allowed China to build up bilateral relationships that have an impact on weakening the overall security network that the United States really relies upon. You can see that in NATO. It's hugely problematic that what do you do when you suddenly have an illiberal ally in the middle of NATO? How does NATO continue to operate as effectively as it would have in the past? These are the kinds of things that I think the US hasn't actually had to wrestle with in a while. But increasingly, we're going to have to think about that. And it's become a real problem in some places. The other, I think, echoing again what I was saying earlier about tools really mattering. You know, China, in a lot of cases, is very successfully selling tools, whether that's facial recognition, surveillance equipment, and U.S. allies buy them as well, and close U.S. security partners buy them as well, because they can use them for all sorts of things that they'd really like to. It's easy to say that a tool is, you know, has nothing to do with democracy or norms, but countries can use these in ways that actually erode domestically the space for civil society, the space for the kinds of ecosystems that a democracy needs to flourish. And so I think you have to pay attention, not simply to just, is China going around trying to spread communism, but are they actually selling the kinds of tools that when you use those over time, make it more easy for authoritarian leaders and authoritarianism to take root in a country.
Great, thanks, Lindsay. Jeffrey, if I could put you on, yeah, perfect.
I was going to say, I was just gonna make a comment.
To the diplomatic angle. Thank you.
That that China does like to talk about democracy in the UN when it talks about equality between states. You know, so their definition in the UN context is each state, each member state is equal. Each member state has a vote. And again, it's part of an overall Chinese narrative that you take the words that we use to describe how individuals are affected by their governments. It's, you know, whether it's human rights, democracy, et cetera, and apply it to interstate relations. So you take the concept, but you distort it to define relations between states rather than what the relations are between the governors and the governed. I will say that China has not objected or tried to interfere with the UN's electoral assistance. That's, you know, that's designed to provide technical assistance to try to build credibility for elections. And that is because the election assistance that the UN provides is only done with member state consent. Member states ask for UN to provide electoral assistance. The UN responds in kind. And that fortunately has not been an issue, but mostly in the broad diplomatic context within the United Nations, when China talks about democracy, they're talking about the relations between the states that are members of the United Nations.
Please, Sophie.
Yeah, I just wanted to tack on a quick observation / question to Dave as a fellow veteran of the world of election monitoring and electoral assistance. I find it fascinating that the Chinese government now provides electoral assistance to other governments. I mean, Jeff, sort of picking up a bit on your point, and you know, you really, I think, have to wonder what expertise there is on offer there. Mostly, it's been the provision of equipment up to and including ballot boxes. You know, but David, love your thoughts on whether you think that's an effort to actually, you know, co-opt or undermine norms around the idea of electoral assistance, to, you know, posit the idea that one doesn't have to be a democracy to provide assistance to a democratic process. Thoughts on what that's all about?
Yeah, that's something that I've watched closely, as I know you have, and it's fascinating to watch. I mean, especially, you know, in a place like, you know, Cambodia, where obviously China has done a lot to at least facilitate the slide in the wrong direction under Hun Sen, and you know, as you're saying, kind of monitoring and then legitimizing an election and saying, yep, it's all good here. This was a fair and clean democratic election. I think it's definitely worth watching right now. It seems kind of almost amusing, but it's not. This is serious, and I think that the drive is to basically set up an equivalence between, you know, China is just as much right as the United States or any other kind of international NGO to be going in and monitoring these processes and making sure that they're, you know, free and fair without the assumption, the normative assumption that it has to be done in a purely democratic fashion to be legitimate. And I think that it points in a direction too, where not just in the election space, although I think, you know, for IRI and others, that's really critical. Just going forward, you know, we've looked a lot at what China's doing in terms of providing governance training to countries and coming in and you know, kind of increasingly being willing to, through its new development agency, you know, kind of color, make it a little bit more gray who has the legitimate right to be talking about governance and good governance. I think we're going to be going more and more in a direction where on the ground in countries, you'll have Western or democracy favoring organizations pushing their versions of governance, and China on its own coming in and saying, well, we're doing the same. We're just doing it from a different vantage point. It's going to be a brave new world in terms of both election monitoring and in terms of governance assistance, because I think China's becoming much more bold in that direction. And 10 years from now, we may be looking at a very different situation on the ground in many of these countries.
It's a great juncture to move on. Linked to the topic of democracy is China's relationship, of course, with human rights, both domestically and abroad. And for this, we'll shift to Sophie Richardson, who is China Director with Human Rights Watch. Sophie, really looking forward to your thoughts. To start, in your recent paper, you write that, quote, one can no longer pretend that China has its borders. And you mentioned several cases where pressure from Beijing has led to self-censorship and job losses. Looking ahead, do you see anything more serious coming, perhaps as an extension of the new national security law in Hong Kong, that would represent an even greater threat to both Chinese citizens and non-Chinese citizens outside of its borders, you know, arrest, detainments, and so forth?
Great. Patrick, thanks for the question. Thanks for inviting me to join you. You know, in a way, I'm going to make your question even bleaker, because it's not just what we're worried about in the future. It's what we're not paying enough attention to right now. I think some people are aware that the new national security law imposed on Hong Kong at the end of June by Beijing includes, for example, a clause saying that the law will be applied extraterritorially, meaning that anyone criticizing Beijing anywhere in the world could, in theory, be prosecuted under this law. There are relatively straightforward fixes to that, which is, you know, involves governments refusing to cooperate with that. Some have already suspended extradition treaties in response, although that's not quite the same thing as saying they won't cooperate. But, you know, that has, you know, there are real consequences for people around the world as they stop and think, as 7 million people in Hong Kong now have to, whether something they're going to say out loud or publish or wear or a sign they're going to hold might somehow, you know, cause offense to Beijing. But I think what's frightening about this is that, you know, it's one of the kinds of problems that we can see, that we know about, and to which there is a clear response. I think the Chinese government's threats to the freedom of expression worldwide are extraordinary, but on some level not very clearly seen. And I want to give you a couple for the purposes of our discussion this morning. In the category of what you can see, here's one example. Last week, the UK mission to the Human Rights Council in Geneva announced that it was going to be holding an event this week to talk about Hong Kong. Full disclosure, I'm on it. Shortly after they announced the event and publicized it, the Chinese mission in Geneva issued a note verbal telling other governments they shouldn't go to or participate in this event. Now, that's only distributed to governments, but often one gets to see these things. But, you know, they're clearly, the Chinese government is taking an anti-free speech position. It could go ahead and just organize its own side event. It is now also doing that. But, you know, the message that goes out to other governments is stay away from that discussion. We'll be watching to see who participates. Beijing also introduced a new resolution at the Human Rights Council last week. This one is called Putting People at the Center of Efforts in Promoting and Protecting Human Rights. Again, as Jeff alluded to earlier, this is another kind of document that slowly leeches out responsibility for states or a role for independent civil society. There's not a lot of room for free expression in either of those two. But, you know, a couple of weeks ago, we organized a sign-on statement for NGOs all over the world that was essentially calling for greater scrutiny of China at the Human Rights Council. And I'm very sad to have to recount to all of you that we had a number of civil society groups based either here in the US or in Western Europe who were extremely keen to join, but were reluctant to do so even anonymously because they felt that somehow their participation would be known and that that would be held against them, particularly in their pursuit of accreditation status for the UN. We're all watching how universities around the world not only are grappling with China-related free speech issues on their campuses, for example, when students have held pro-Hong Kong democracy protests and they are attacked or shut down by other voices. We've watched dozens of universities in those circumstances stop publicly at saying we respect everybody's rights to free speech, but not taking the additional steps of making it clear what that really means, that those kinds of discussions are precisely what should happen on campuses, that people can have robust debate, but that they may not threaten one another physically, that that classroom conversations can't be reported to consulates. These are real problems for universities who are now also, because of the pandemic, grappling with the challenges of holding classes, for example, via Zoom, with students who are essentially stuck in the mainland who might otherwise be on campuses elsewhere, and trying to figure out what to say to those students about accessing material or class discussions that might be considered sensitive by local authorities. That's a very real issue for them. Some of them have taken, I think, reasonably responsible and progressive steps. But we now live in an age when Ivy League universities in the United States are having to come up with a solution that involves students submitting papers anonymously or coded by number to try to minimize the opportunity that the students who wrote them, who are sitting in China, might get into trouble for writing on those topics. You know, think about how a university, any one single university, grapples with that problem. And then down towards, on the issues that I think are really not on people's radar screens are the kinds of not just constant threats to public or vocal members of diaspora communities who are critical of the Chinese government. But we've done work looking at whether people who've emigrated from China, say, to Canada or Australia, who are not particularly politically engaged, but whether they feel sufficiently confident, having obtained these other citizenships, making full use of those rights to criticize the Chinese government. And many of them tell us that they are not. That's a pretty powerful state of affairs, that somebody who's even gone through the process of obtaining these rights in a place where they should be defended aren't. that even having those rights better protected doesn't necessarily give people the confidence to act on them. And I think there are a whole range of steps that states need to take. At the multilateral level, or at the UN in particular, I think if a group of rights-respecting governments don't come together soon to provide a credible, long-standing counterweight to what the Chinese government is trying to accomplish, the system that we all rely on around the world for our human rights to be protected is going to be that much weaker. But I also think there's a whole range of steps individual governments need to take to contemplate these kinds of threats to the freedom of expression inside their own countries. It's not an issue I think governments have really had to grapple with, and it requires a very different kind of response.
Thanks, Sophie. You promised a bleak picture and you delivered a bleak picture. Picking up on your comment with regard to engagement on this issue in the UN system, given the discrepancies with the values championed by the UN Human Rights Council and the practices by some of its members like China, to what extent do you think this institution can be reformed? And how, if at all, do you think the US rejoining the council could provide a more balanced platform to oppose erosion of human rights by China and other liberal actors?
Well, on the first point, I think there are some changes that an organization like Human Rights Watch would want to see. For example, to make the elections more competitive. Often states are elected through closed slates, or they aren't really in any way obliged to campaign in a way you know, that really stacks up pledges against what member states are expected to do. But I think a lot of the tools are there to make it an effective institution if member states actually uphold, you know, the obligations and the expectations, which, you know, clearly China is not. As for the U.S., look, it's, you know, we will always want truly rights-respecting governments that have international rights-respecting agendas to be on the council. I think Human Rights Watch has a lot of concerns about the Trump administration's track record on human rights. So what I want people to do is not necessarily assume that we think any U.S. administration is going to, by definition, going to be an asset. That said, I think it has been harder for, you know, the real like-minded rights-respecting governments on the council to collectively push back against Beijing's pressure. I think we have seen more of that around a couple of recent developments, resolutions, other kinds of initiatives. But China will run to rejoin the council this fall, and it will almost certainly be reelected. And I think that is just going to put more pressure on the governments that really do care, not just about immediate issues, but on the health of the system as a whole, to work hard and work together and set themselves a very ambitious agenda.
Great. Thanks, Sophie. Before we shift to the questions that are flowing in via Twitter from the audience, I wanted to open it back up one last time to the panelists. Any thoughts on Sophie's remarks and the question more broadly of China's engagement vis-a-vis human rights, both domestically and abroad?
Sophie, thanks for that bleak picture that you painted. It was very deep insights, and I was just reminded hearing you talk about what's been happening in Geneva lately with the UK proposal for a discussion on Hong Kong, another UK initiative back in the fall, back in October when the UK was working through the General Assembly was developing a letter criticizing the Chinese treatment of the Uyghurs. And the UK managed to get 22 member states to sign on. China then had an alternative letter that praised China's human rights record, China's human rights practices, China's perspective on human rights, and they got 54 member states to sign its letter.
Yeah, look, that's what China does. But my first response to that is to suggest people look at the list of signatories on the Chinese government's initiative. You know, when your cheerleaders include North Korea and Zimbabwe and Venezuela, it's a little hard to take seriously the integrity of a counter proposal. I think it's been particularly disappointing to see episodes, for example, like Pakistan on behalf of the OIC praising the Chinese government's response or policies against Uyghurs. But the fact remains, these are the institutions that exist. We're not going to stop encouraging governments to do what they can to do the right thing. I also think, as we started to talk about a little bit earlier, there's a little bit less support there than the Chinese government wants you to believe. You know, if you look at some of the states that have been alienated by diplomatic overreach, ones who are pushing back for principled reasons. There are sort of different constituencies of governments. There are some that are very angry about what's happened in Hong Kong. There are some that are horrified by what's happening to Uyghurs. There are some who are angry about Chinese government censorship in the early days of the coronavirus pandemic. And some of that is translating into pushback at this institution. But you know, when frustrated or beleaguered diplomats express some frustration to us, one of the points that we try to make back to them is that, you know, they have access to call for scrutiny and accountability of Chinese government authorities that most people in China won't ever have, and that they're duty bound to make use of that opportunity to push for better rights protections.
One additional thought on this, and it perhaps is obvious, but, you know, obviously these international institutions, the UN that we're talking about, are made up of hundreds of individual countries. And if in those individual countries, China is able to exert a increasing level of influence and leverage through either elite capture, through shaping the information space, through any number of vectors, that's going to create a situation where ultimately when the cost benefit comes for these countries to make their vote or decide who they're going to side with or be public about what they're going to be public about, they're going to decide that they don't want, that it's not worth the risk to come out against China on any of these issues that Sophie's talking about.
Yeah, it's true. I will just say that sometimes we do see states take, I think, gutsy positions that, you know, other interests might suggest a different course of action. For example, one of the governments that's now joined up to being critical of Beijing's policies towards Xinjiang is Albania, you know, a country that could go in a very different direction. You know, one of the governments that voted for, one of the governments that voted against the mutually beneficial cooperation resolution recently was the Marshall Islands. You know, but I think it's also illustrative to think about, you know, other major international human rights crises that the Council has addressed where there's been a lot of enthusiasm. And, you know, think, for example, about the Gambia taking Myanmar to the International Court of Justice over treatment of the Rohingya. Flip that around, I think an important taboo got broken at the last Human Rights Council session when member states came together to demand significantly heightened HRC scrutiny of police violence and abuses against racist police abuse here in the U.S., you know, an initiative that Human Rights Watch certainly supported. Look at all the governments that were happy to be supportive of, you know, that kind of scrutiny of a P5 member state. That breaks an important taboo, but I also think it makes it that much more important to hold other P5 member states like China accountable too for serious human rights violations.
Great. Thanks again, Sophie, for those remarks. So we're about an hour in, and during that period, lots of questions coming in by Twitter from the audience. I'd like to pose a few to the panelists here, starting with Tejas Shah, who's an attorney with Barnes and Thornburg. He asks to the panel, does China have more to gain or lose from the preservation of international institutions? So welcome thoughts from the four panelists.
I'm happy to start that one off if you want.
Yeah, please.
I think the Chinese government believes it has a lot to gain from remaking certain kinds of international institutions in the way it wants, and a certain amount to lose from failing to do that. And by that, I really mean, you know, some of the pathologies that we've been talking about here, where, you know, human rights scrutiny, at least from the Chinese government's perspective, should be more a matter of state-to-state dialogue, not of binding consequential legal action or an active role for international or even local civil society initiatives. I think that's what really fuels a fair amount of the Chinese government's conduct, at least at the Human Rights Council, but I'm sure my co-panelists have views about other kinds of institutions.
Patrick, I'll jump in now. Echoing what Sophie said, in terms of the United Nations in New York, the UN is a safe space for China. The UN is hierarchical. The UN, at least in terms of the secretariat, the staff, the secretary general, tend to be deferential to great powers. It's safe space. So I think that China wants to, as we've discussed, would like to substitute the liberal operating system of the UN for its own, for something more reflecting of its own. But in general, I think that they like the universality. They feel confident that even with the rising concerns we've talked about by some member states that their relations with the G77 and non-aligned movement gives them an advantage in an organization that has universal membership, gives them some advantages. At the same time, you know, they do hedge their bets a bit in terms of the existing multilateral system. You know, you set up the SCO, you set up the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank. So you maintain, China maintains its role, expands its assertiveness in the existing system, while also creating some parallel institutions with specific purposes. And frankly, this is a lesson they've taken from us. After World War II, we set up a layered multilateral system with various components to do different things, NATO for security, the UN for this, et cetera. So in a way, China's imitating us in how we dealt with multilateralism after World War II, but of course doing it with a far different operating system inside.
Yeah, I completely agree with what Jeff just said. And for me, I think this was one of the main points I was trying to make in my paper is when you look at what China's doing institutionally, it's actually kind of similar to the way that the US has done things, which is layering together smaller types of institutional cooperation where the Chinese can have more influence and they can really sort of build deep cooperation with specific countries, as well as within broader institutions where sometimes I think it's been frustrating for the Chinese that they haven't actually been able to reshape those organizations as effectively as they might want to sometimes. You know, they can use those smaller mechanisms to reshape the bigger organizations. So it's neither an either or. It's not an in or out when it comes to the international system. It's both and. And that's really difficult, I think, for the United States, because the relationship between some of these parallel institutions and the existing UN system is reinforcing in some cases, and the Chinese try to encourage that.
Yeah, I'll just chime in and say I agree with everything that's said, and I think Lindsay put it really well there. I think it would be much easier if China was revolutionary in the sense that they were trying to blow up all the international institutions that are existing right now. It's much harder to deal with the China that comes in and wants to revise and in many cases wants to keep the form of many of these institutions, but effectively change their function and change the very nature of them and neuter the values-oriented aspects and not necessarily replace those values with Chinese Communist Party values or set up little mini Chinese Communist parties everywhere, but effectively knock off liberal values is kind of the underpinning of many of these institutions. And for China, you know, China is trying, as we've discussed earlier, to put itself out there as the responsible risen great power, the democratization of international relations and China's rise, the China dream, the community of common destiny is going to benefit all. And so if they can repurpose a lot of these institutions to serve those goals and to shape this vision of China as leading on climate change, on leading a lot of really critical transnational issues, that's what they're going to do while still, you know, as we've discussed, kind of quietly, somewhat quietly and gradually just eviscerating the values aspects that are inherent to many of these institutions.
Great. Thanks everyone for answering Tejas's question. So another question came in from Robert Keeley, a self-identified consultant. He writes, looking ahead to the election, how might a Biden administration go about pushing China to adhere to human rights? And if I could add to the questions, or how might a second Trump term, what would that look like in terms of pushing China to adhere to human rights norms, I think he, and laws he might be referring to?
Shall I kick us off?
Please.
Sure. Foresight being the flawed exercise that it is, I would assume that we would see the Trump administration continue down the path of using primarily targeted sanctions, either against individuals, against Chinese government agencies, or against companies in response to serious human rights violations. We've now seen the Global Magnitsky Act used the addition of companies and the entire Xinjiang Public Security Bureau and the Xinjiang Bingtuan, the XPCC, to the entities list. This seems to be the preferred tool that this administration has used, and I assume we would see more of that in the future. I have no predictions about whether a second Trump administration would want to try to run for the Human Rights Council. I assume a Biden administration would do that. I assume we would see it perhaps use some of those same kinds of tactics, meaning about sanctions or additions to the entities list. But I think there would probably hope there would perhaps be a strong emphasis on working with other like-minded governments, not just at the Human Rights Council, but on other kinds of initiatives to promote or protect human rights defenders, to push back on the kinds of threats to the freedom of expression inside countries that we see, some more both multilateral and sort of heightened domestic attention to some of these kinds of issues. But I'd love to know what Lindsay and Jeff and David think too.
I'll jump in here and say, I mean, I know this is, by now it's oft repeated, but I think probably a Biden administration and potentially a reelected Trump administration, I think there's a recognition increasingly of the importance of working with partners and allies on these issues. And, you know, I think that there's some momentum in a positive direction where we see our European friends now awakening to the fact that we're dealing with more of what could be termed a systemic challenge from China, a values challenge, a challenge to universal human rights. A real concern, not just, you know, I think we talked about how China's wolf warrior approach and disinformation around COVID, I think really woke up a lot of people in Europe and in other countries. But I think also what's been happening with the crackdown in Hong Kong, what's been, you know, increasing awareness of what's happening in Xinjiang has really started to turn the tide there. And so I think that there's a lot of room to run in terms of working with our allies and partners, either in some sort of more formalized summit or concert of democracies, which is something that Vice President Biden has discussed, or just other ways in which there's a more concerted, united approach to pushing China on some of these rights issues that I think is inevitably going to be much more effective, not just because you have more countries involved, but because it's more clearly not just about a U.S. trying to keep China down by focusing on what it's doing at home. This is not just a kind of purely realist great power competition. This is really about what a risen China under the Chinese Communist Party means for the world, and the fact that what it's been doing at home for a very long time is now increasing. It's now increasingly clear what a big problem that is for the rest of the world. And so I think that that there's a lot of coordination and a lot of joint efforts that can be undertaken in the next 4 years by whoever is president working with our partners.
Great. Thanks, Dave and Sophie. With the few minutes left, one question that came in from C. Yang, from Voice of America, for Jeffrey. They write, can Mr. Feltman speak to China's increasing role in UN peacekeeping forces? What is the prime driver for China's approach towards UN peacekeeping, from rejection to join the forces to fighting for the lead role in such missions? So over to you, Jeffrey.
I think as people know, China has more blue helmets, more Chinese nationals in blue helmets than all the other P5 combined. There are about 2,500 Chinese nationals serving in UN peacekeeping forces, mostly in Africa, a few in Lebanon. This is part of China's increasing role in the peace and security agenda in the United Nations. China traditionally focused on the economic and social affairs part of the UN, but under President Xi Jinping, they're much more. They have expanded their work on peace and security. They're basically doing what other P5 members have done in the past: blocking Secretary General appointments, insisting on a Chinese national for a special envoy here or deputy special representative there. This is very much like the other P5. Peacekeeping, however, they have more blue helmets than the others combined. As I said, they're in Africa. Part of this was they used the Chinese peacekeeping as part of their explanation for their port in Djibouti. You know, that this is that their port, their military assets in Djibouti are designed to support their peacekeeping forces. Of course, their special envoy for the Great Lakes, the UN special envoy, who's the Chinese national, the first Chinese national to take a UN special envoy job, is the special envoy for the Great Lakes region in Africa. I see this, therefore, as part of two elements. One, the increasing focus by China on the peace and security agenda, the heart of the UN, the irreducible purpose of the UN. And two, China's overall interest in markets and relations in Africa.
Patrick, can I just add a quick point to that? I realize the question was directed
Please.
To Jeff, but I do think it's worth noting that the Chinese government has also tried a couple of times now in increasing its support for peacekeeping operations to cut the human rights component from those operations. So it's, you know, there's an additional agenda there too, and further limiting, you know, what's been a reasonably important kind of human rights monitoring in that part of the UN.
Yeah, that's a great point, Sophie. Thank you. So with that, we are at time. It's been really excellent, stimulating discussion. Sophie, on our collective behalf, thank you so much to Suzanne Maloney and her Global China team. And thank you all out there for joining us today in this live stream event. Take care, everyone, and have a great day.